Chapter 7. The Queen dozed restlessly for a few hours, and then woke with a start. The sun was threatening to rise. Five dogs breathed peacefully on her satin bed coverings around Cerulea. One of them snored loudly. Nana slumbered in a chair, her feet up on a footstool, with Cressa's oldest winter cloak spread over her face and body. Cressa got up off the couch, tiptoed to her adjoining washroom, and as noiselessly as possible dressed in a skirt and tunic simple enough for her to pull on without assistance. As she moved back through the room, two of the dogs opened their eyes and regarded her. The large one merely closed its lids. The small one stood and circled round on the quilts before settling back down with an elaborate exhalation. Cressa perched in a window seat, cracking open the wooden shutter for the sight of the light's first fingers touching the snow-capped Nargis Mountain. The Nargis River tumbled down from this single peak and then flowed underground through Cascada, showing itself only in the Nargis Fountain in the middle of the city and the Dedication Fountain in the middle of the throne room. But the palace's wells drew on Nargis water. Thus so did the water feature in her bedchamber, the Queen's Water Wall, a spot where water flowed down a rock surface to an enamelled pool in which floated a cluster of jewelled water lilies. The water lily swayed in the slightly undulating water, today providing no comfort.
"Intruders made it into my daughter's room. What connection lies between this attack and Oromondo? Are any members of court involved?" Little waves of panic intermittently coursed through her body, sometimes making her give little jerks. She desperately wished for Ambrise at her side, but he was hundreds of leagues away, pursuing Pellish pirates as her lord of the ships. Cressa's parents, whose marriage had never been convivial, had separated after the death of her infant brother on his sixth night. King Nithanel had returned to Lothrod and his two sons by his previous marriage, while Katrina had remained in Cascada. Her mother had sent Cressa every summer to visit Lothrod for an extended stay. Doubtless, Katrina considered herself bound to maintain her daughter's ties to her father. Unfortunately, the long sea voyages and absences made Cressa a stranger both to the nobility and the lower ranks of her homeland. Cressa's own marriage had not brought her more allies. Ambrise was not a king, nor duke, nor even a member of a rich merchant family. He had been the seamaster of Sea Sprite, which had taken her to Lothrod when she was 19. Broad-chested and tall, calm with a dry sense of humour. By the time the ship had finished the long voyage back to Weirendale, she had fallen in love. In Ambrise's arms, she had found her home. She had thought her mother would bar the match, seeing no advantage in it for the realm. But rather than be the pawn of one of her mother's stratagems, Cressa had been determined that, if only in this one matter, she would follow her heart. She had entered her mother's closet with clenched jaw and balled fists, ready to defy her mother and sovereign. Oddly enough, Katrina had merely looked pensive at Cressa's announcement and then wished her joy. The lightest tap on her bedroom door roused Cressa from her memories and worries. The dogs did not react, so she loosed her hand from the dagger she had instinctively thrust in her belt after robing. She opened the door quietly, glancing behind, and noting with relief that Nana and Cerulea slept on. Captain Clemson and Sergeant Bristle, both unshaven and unchanged, though with freshly scrubbed hands and faces, stood in her reception room, along with several servants and all four of her ladies. The ladies fluttered about, and one of them handed her a sealed note. Ordering fast break, she motioned for the men to follow her and led the way to her closet down the hallway so that voices would not disturb Cerulea. The same catamount, or it might have been one of the other three, sprawled in the hallway on its side. It supervised the human's movements without expression.
A fire blazed in the room, providing a semblance of comfort. As soon as the door was closed, Clemson broke out.
"I bring ill tidings, Your Majesty. The prisoners are dead. They died before we could question them. We believe they were poisoned."
"Tell me." Plink.
"We summoned healers to them where they lay yonder."
Sergeant Bristle spoke rapidly, pulling on his mangled left ear, deformed by some long ago altercation.
"Two of them did some stitching up and bandaging. The other gave them what she said was a fortifying tonic to build them back up after their blood loss. We carried them down to the cells. They moaned as we shifted them. Then by the time we got them down there, both got quiet-like. But when we tried to question them, their faces went queer and they spoke only gibberish. A half hour later, they were like in a deep sleep. We couldn't wake them, not with water or shaking. Nothing roused them."
Plink.
"We sent for healers and they said the wretches lay a-dying. In a wee bit, they was dead as dirt." "I'm at fault. I called for healers."
Clemson was loyal to the bone and willing to take responsibility for everything that went wrong.
"If it had not been the healer's draft, they would have found some other way to deal with any captives," said Cressa. "They would have poisoned their water or your food or started a fire. Think about the planning that must have gone into this attack. They were prepared for any eventuality. You hardly had a chance of interrogating any assailants left alive." Plink.
"You're probably right,"
Clemson replied, scratching his lip stubble.
"Whoever they are."
"Have you identified the healer?"
"A dark-haired woman," said Bristle. "We've asked. Neither of the others know who she was. Each thought the other knew her, and it was all rather confused last night. No one thought to question the pig-fucking healers. Begging your pardon, ma'am."
A knock on the door announced Lady Denista carrying a tray with bread, cheese and fruit for their repast. The full pot of holly tisane emitted a welcome fragrance. Denista poured out cups.
"Will there be anything else, Your Majesty?"
Plink.
"No, Denista." "Wouldn't you like me to stay and take notes for you?"
"That will not be necessary. You may leave now." They ate and drank in silence, all too tense to sit down. The water droplet from the weeping swan hit the surface below it in the quiet room. Plink.
"Did you find out anything from examining the bodies?"
"Aye," replied Bristle. "All 10 fit and not so young. Men who might have had some experience fighting, scars on their bodies, highwaymen, could be, or could be mercenaries. And we found these," said Clemson, "sewn into the bottom seams of their trousers."
He reached into a purse hanging around his waist, pulled out a leather pouch and turned it upside down on the mahogany table. Gemstones spilled out. Emeralds, diamonds, rubies and sapphires, a queen's ransom. Plink. More than the news of the poison, the sight of the fortune gave Cressa chills.
"Someone wants me dead enough to pay this much. Who has this much wealth?"
While Cressa toyed with the gems, the guards poured themselves more strong tisane.
"Why would they have kept their payment on their persons?"
Plink.
"No one's going to leave that treasure in a stash house. There's more," said Clemson. "Last night a footman saw a set of men being let into the compound through the front gate by palace guards."
Bristle broke in.
"Palace guards, ma'am, not the Queen's Shield."
"Which means the palace guard is bought off,"
Cressa breathed.
"Or the assassins had a pass note from someone unquestionable," Clemson said. "We'll be asking."
"A pass note from someone from her council? But if the palace soldiers have been bought, or some portion of them, why wouldn't they attack? Why hire assassins in the first place?" asked Cressa.
"Soldiers' sense of honour.
said Clemson. Plink.
"'Tis one thing to open a gate and look the other way, or accept a pass note and let in strange armed men. 'Tis quite another thing to take a sword to your queen yourself. Look how much they had to pay."
So the intruders were well funded. They had been chosen carefully. They had a plan.
Why didn't they succeed?
Your forewarning, my shields, and all the animals.
Bristle emitted a low whistle.
Of the 8 killed on the roof, terrace, and the stairs, the beasts took 5.
Plink.
You should see what was done to him. Chewed him up right proper. 2 died from both blades and teeth, and only 1 in a proper fight, that is, a human fight. That was Dalek's kill. Rest his soul on the waters.
Dalek?
Fought off one of the intruders,
Clemson answered.
Put him down, too, but the bastard snagged an artery before he died.
I regret I neglected to ask if all my shields were safe, said the Queen.
Did his duty, Dalek. Honourable death.
Clemson shook off the sympathy. Yes, well, they underestimated us once. They won't do that again. Now what? Will they poison the dogs and the catamounts? They can't kill the catamounts. Catamounts have served as guardians of the throne going back for hundreds of years. Plink.
If the plotters are treacherous enough to threaten your life, Your Majesty, I doubt they will scruple over mountain lions, no matter how entwined with legend.
Yet the catamounts are so deadly. The Queen clung to the thought of their protection.
I wager some steady bowman could put them down. In daylight, that is.
Clemson shrugged.
Same with the dogs.
He drank more tisane. Plink. Cressa envisioned the mountain lions, each pierced by a score of arrows. I see, she replied, feeling somewhat faint. A long silence blanketed the room. Cressa felt her eyelid twitch. To cover this up, she started pacing. Who amongst my shields fought most bravely last night?
Cena stood her ground. She did real good,
Bristle said.
And Pontol? On the terrace fought like a demon,
added Clemson. He addressed his sergeant.
You would have been proud of his attack and his parries.
Plink. Fine. I would like those 2 assigned to protect the Princella. I want to send them with her out of the palace today, ordered Cressa, with her dogs. Have them ready in an hour. Captain, she continued. Once my daughter is out of the palace, I wish the 10 men's bodies displayed in the middle of the courtyard. Strip them naked. Let all see what happens to those who attack the throne. And could be someone will recognize them. Finally, the Queen swept up one of the gems and handed it to Bristle. Dalek must have had some kin. Make sure that this is sent to his family with my compliments and condolences. I would like that done right away. She picked up a green stone cut with unusual facets that caught her eye. And I have use for this, too. Keep the other gems on your person, Captain. Now, if you will excuse me, gentlemen, I have an important audience to hold. After they left, Cressa lingered over the food a minute. She had only nibbled while she conversed, and she needed to fortify herself for this day. She poured herself some more tisane. Plink. As she supped, she recalled the note handed her by Lady Fania. It read,
Your Majesty, I could be of such comfort to you at this trying time. Send for me so I can assist you. Your most obedient servant, Matwick.
Cressa crumpled the note and threw it in the fireplace. As she watched it flame up, she held her hands to the extra heat, thinking about how fire both destroyed and warmed. She returned to her bedchamber and woke up Nana and Cerulea. She hustled her daughter into a riding habit.
Cressa told her ladies to stay behind and escorted the Princella down to the stables, personally giving the two shields their instructions. They were to leave the palace grounds and ride leisurely in the western hills on unpredictable paths. They were to buy food and drink at wayside carts or inns. They were to keep the three big dogs with them at all times. The little party must return as quietly as possible, just before dark. By the grace of the waters, Cerulea showed no ill effects from last night. Her daughter thought this was a big adventure, to ride off on smoke all day long, and Cressa felt relieved to get her away. The queen hurried back to her chamber and sent Nana to supervise the scouring and setting to rights of the Princella's suite. Then she called her maids and ladies and told them to lay out one of her most magnificent gowns and fix her long blue locks with extra care.
"Your Majesty, are you all right?"
asked Lady Fania, devoid of witticisms this morning.
"What happened? We've had all sorts of wild things,"
Denista chimed in on top of her.
"What did your shields have to say?" asked Lumetta.
Cressa had no strength to be tactful. "Ladies, I had very little sleep. I need quiet while I dress." Rebuffed, they attended her in tight-lipped silence and left the room sullenly once she was robed. Later, when Jacilla, her youngest and sweetest maid, was alone in the dressing room fixing her hair, Cressa reached for her hand, while inwardly she reached for her talent. She experienced a queer sensation, something akin to unexpectedly tapping into a large, still pool in an underground cavern that had been there all the time, just waiting for her.
"Jacilla, are you loyal to me?" she asked.
"You have treated me with kindness, Your Majesty," Jacilla spoke as if bewitched. "But Lord Retzel pays me double and has promised my beau a job as overseer if I report everything I know to him."
Cressa's pulse galloped.
"I see," said Cressa. "You will forget I asked." She dropped the girl's hand.
"Oh, this style is so fetching," said Jacilla, putting in the last ornament. "Is there anything else I can do for you? Anything at all?"
"No," said the queen. "That will be all." Alone in her dressing room, Cressa stood up. Anger made her sway for a moment. "They've played me for a fool and a weakling. Indeed, I've acted the fool and the weakling." A short time later, clad in a gown of pale yellow, a cap with a yellow veil, and a coordinating long lace train held up by Lady Denista and Lady Aubrey, Cressa entered the throne room via a side entrance. Three of her councillors, Belcazar, Lady Tenny, and General Jurgen, expected her, concern etched on their faces, which was unsurprising because news travelled quickly around court. Envoy Thumb awaited their pleasure outside the formal doors of the east entrance. Cressa seated herself on the Nargis throne on the dais. The throne of Weirendale, and thus the surrounding palace, had been built precisely here because of a natural spring of Nargis water. Centuries ago, Chister the Builder had had a tall, jagged quartz pinnacle strategically placed so that the water sprayed up one side and then cascaded like a waterfall down the other, carving a smooth channel, tumbling to fill the golden coronation basin set at waist height. The water spilled over the basin's rim into the floor-level dedication pool and was carried away by pipes laid under the floor. The slight mist, which gave Cressa its characteristic tingle, cooled the twitch of her left eye.
The four catamounts lounged by the dedication pool and the coronation basin. Nargis water exerted some mystical pull over them. Sometimes they bathed in the spray of the fountain and they drank from the pool. At night, in turns, they might leave the throne room through their tunnel exit, discreetly set in the throne room floor, to hunt in the wild hills that abutted the palace. But, in general, they preferred to stay close to the pool, basin, fountain, and throne. Mostly, they ignored people in the throne room, but even while sleeping, they radiated an aura of protectiveness over the queen. Colourful, historic tapestries hung along the walls on the lower level. Interior balconies, where the gentry stood to watch notable occasions, ringed the mid-story. Above the third story, Queen Caelithia the artist had designed a vaulted roof of stained glass in a pattern of tiny, clear white and blue panes. Daylight and moonlight streamed into the throne room through these panes, refracting into multicoloured arcs. To stand inside the throne room was to feel as if one sat inside the rainbows made by the Nargis fountain in the courtyard of the star. General Jurgen approached Cressa and bent a knee.
Your Majesty, I have seen too much bloodshed in my life. Peace is always preferable to war, as life is always better than death. Yet the Oros must pay for this outrage against you and your daughter.
Cressa nodded, touched by his protestation, but not trusting herself to speak. Her counsellors seated themselves in chairs on a step below the queen. Cressa arranged to have trouble with her long lace train tangling between her foot and the throne, a simple low-backed chair well proportioned for a woman, made of white gold and upholstered in white velvet.
Lady Tenny, would you assist me?
Tenny obliged, and when Cressa, in shifting her weight off the train, reached for Tenny's hand to steady herself, Tenny offered it without hesitation.
Good, but not conclusive.
Tenny, you will start the audience and question the envoy. Lady Dinister, pray tell the caller we are ready for him now.
The palace caller announced in her most ringing tones, Envoy Thumb of Oromondo!
Thumb, a thick man, rigid with muscle, with snow-white hair brushed straight upward, walked ponderously down the long approach. Of his armour, he wore only a ceremonial breastplate, adorned with the 8 red flames of Oromondo, but it looked extremely heavy. When he reached the dais, he bowed his head slightly, but did not bend his knee. The four catamounts sprang erect from their negligent poses. Their tails lashed and four sets of eyes pinned him like prey.
Cressa couldn't help admiring the way Thumb stood his ground without shrinking backward.
Though Jurgen kept his face a mask, Belcazar's eyes hardened with anger. The councillors looked at Queen Cressa. She lazily circled her hand to proceed.
Envoy Thumb, said Tenny, biting each syllable. What is the meaning of the document you delivered to Her Majesty yesterday?
Can you not read? He replied.
I can't read rubbish, she snapped. How dare Oromondo propagate such calumnies against Weirendale and against the throne? Civilized countries do not resort to insults, threats, and far-fetched accusations. In all my days I have never read the like of this letter. Did you write this yourself?
Civilized? What do you know of being civilized?
Thumb retorted with a sneer. Tenny stared at him, dumbfounded.
Civilized countries do not worship witches and the poison food. Thumb continued.
Weirendale has never and would never. Poison foodstuffs, said Lady Tenny. You've been stationed here, what, 5 years? Don't you know us weirs by now?
I don't know her.
He pointed his chin at Cressa.
At all.
Cressa had attended numerous tedious gatherings with international envoys, but at the moment she couldn't recall whether she had made a point of building trust with Envoy Thump.
What makes you think the rice was poisoned? Why would we do such a thing?
General Jurgen asked.
As to the why, I do not pretend to fathom. Those who scorn Posar have no spark. Those who refuse the divinity of the Magi have no morals or souls. Need I remind you of the initial crime?
The initial crime occurred 400 years ago. How long are you going to use that as an excuse for your enmity toward Weirs?
Asked Jurgen.
It is still a revelatory of your barbarism and hostility, Thumb answered.
Blights have affected Oromondo for many decades,
said Belcazar, joining the conversation for the first time.
True, and we recognize these as the curses of the witch queens. I know the rice was tainted because when I was last in my country, I ate some myself. Look at my arm.
He rolled up his red silk sleeve. Oozing sores covered his forearm.
They do not heal, he said. They stink and fester and cause constant pain. And yet my infirmity does not compare to the anguish of our children in their little bellies. Wirrendale's underhanded aggression has caused great suffering throughout the land.
Cressa thought the arm looked nasty indeed.
When Wirrendale wants to be aggressive, said General Jurgen in a steely tone, believe me, Oromondo will know it. Poisoning foodstuffs that children eat is not our style. Underhanded is not our style. Our armies fight with honor.
But,
Belcazar held up one finger,
we investigated the shipments and found them clean. Why do you believe it was the rice that did this or sickened the children rather than some plague or something else you ate? Because the rice is the only new food brought to the land and the only item we imported recently. Do you think we be fools?
Yes, I do think you are foolish, Cressa broke in.
She couldn't claim the intelligence or wisdom of her mother, but she possessed a certain instinct for self-preservation, now fully engaged.
Because you pay your assassins with gems so easily traced back to Oromondo.
She had been clenching the jewel in her fist. Now she threw the emerald down on the ground at Thumb's feet. He picked it up and glanced at it with shock.
Don't deny that this is the cut of an Oro jewelsmith, she warned him.
We can prove as much.
Thumb didn't deny it. He opened his mouth, but no words came out.
We found that on the person of a man who attempted harm to the Nargis throne, she said. What do you know about a gang of assassins sent under cover of darkness?
Thumb held himself up absolutely straight.
I know nothing about assassins, he replied. When Oromondo wants to kill, we do not send assassins in the night. That is without honor.
underhanded is not our style.
And yet you call the queen a witch, threaten her, and then assassins strike in the night. Quite a coincidence, snapped Lady Tenny.
Thumb shrugged.
Oh, with your permission, your majesty, I can't listen to these insults another moment. Guards, hold this man, called General Jürgen. You would arrest an envoy? That's a violation of diplomatic protocol,
Thumb sputtered. Cressa laughed, genuinely.
So is trying to kill the ruler of the host country. Or even just threatening her. Take him away. Give him naught to eat or drink. And keep four guards on him at all times.
While General Jürgen stooped to pick up the dropped emerald, Captain Clemson and Sergeant Bristle entered by a rear side door. Clemson stepped forward to supervise the confinement of the diplomat. Bristle remained behind and looked at the Queen meaningfully. Cressa descended and walked over to him, out of earshot of everyone else.
Your Majesty, one of the scullery girls recognised two of the dead men. They have been delivering wine the last few moons. They was not the regular carter. She knows this because she's sweet on one of them. The regular one, I mean. She says he vanished from this job after summer solstice fest.
So they have been scouting the palace for some 5 moons.
Mm-hmm.
Bristle, Captain Clemson refuses to believe ill of any of the Queen's shield, but you quarter with them. Tell me. Has anyone acted differently recently? Anyone you worry about?
There's one chap.
Bristle's brow wrinkles deepened, but his eyes did not waver.
What concerns you?
Gaffley loves to gamble, but he always loses. Always borrowing coin from everyone who will put up with him. Then about 3 moons ago, he stopped borrowing money. Even paid back his debts, said his luck had changed. But when we play cards, he still loses like a duck, even to Cena. And she's the worst card player I've ever met. Truly, the worst.
Where was Gathley last night?
Mom, he left the grounds last night. Something about a family matter.
Gathley, she mused. I should know him.
Awfully good with a bow, on the young side. Straight, dark brown hair, wears a little moustache.
I remember him now.
So I take him down for questioning with the envoy?
No, Cressa replied, thinking. No. I want you to send him alone to check that the west gate is safely locked. Right now. And then get your horse and night mist saddled. The Queen needs a ride to get some fresh air after these events.
You have a plan, Mom?
Indeed. But if mine should fail, who is better at close quarters fighting?
Me.
She surveyed her sergeant appraisingly. He looked beefy but not young. Seeing doubt in her eyes, he added,
I'm more experienced.
Cressa nodded and ended the conversation. Her counsellors had lingered at a respectful distance awaiting her instructions.
Jürgen, I will meet with you later. Thank you, Lady Tenny. That was most enlightening, she said, dismissing them.
Belcazar, after such excitement, I feel a tad unsteady. Pray give me your arm and escort me to my chambers.
Belcazar rushed to her side and offered his thick forearm for her to lean against. With a brushing away motion of her other hand, Cressa indicated that her retinue should follow at a distance. As they walked down the vaulted passageways and up the royal stair, she spoke to Belcazar softly so no one would overhear.
Can you think of a plausible reason to journey quayside?
He took several steps before responding.
I love fresh bass, and I often go to the docks to pick through the catch myself.
A Trifle odd to go fishmongering on such an eventful day, but that will have to do. Buy some fish. But then, locate the current master of Sea Sprite. Tell him to call in his crew, provision the ship, and be ready to sail tonight. He should do this quietly, but not so furtively as to cause suspicion. If anyone asks, he is to say that we are sending a private ambassador to Oromondo. I may not want Sprite, I may not need it, but I'd like to have it prepared. Balcazar took 3 steps in meditative silence.
Sea Sprite, not Queen Kara.
Sprite, I would suspect the royal galley is being watched. They had reached the outer door of her chambers. Balcazar bent and kissed her hand. As he did so, he muttered,
"I detect your mother's craftiness in you, my queen, and even more daring."
When the door of her personal room closed behind her, Cressa ripped off the yellow gown, reckless as to laces and seams. She got into her riding clothes without calling for any of her maids. Sergeant Bristle waited outside the stables with her night mist and his own black mare. The Queen spoke loudly about how a ride in the fresh air would cure her headache, just in case anyone listened. The afternoon had started to wane. They rode hard on the path toward the West Gate, which lay a league from the palace proper, through grounds of carefully curated oaks, elms and birches, and banks of wide shrubs. Bristle chose a stand of thick-trunked willows where the path came around a curve to bide their time. Cressa found the waiting difficult, so she tried to distract herself with small talk.
"Just yesterday Cerulea played outside without a cloak," she said, pulling her fur-lined cape closer about her.
"Yesterday may have been the last fine day," Bristle grunted. "See that bank of clouds coming in from the north, dark with weather?"
As soon as they heard Gathley's horse hooves returning, they rode out to meet him at a leisurely trot. When they came abreast, everyone reined up. Gathley swept off his hat and bowed.
"Well, man, what did you find?"
"All locked and secure. Clemson has a heavy plank bolted across the gate now."
"That rules West Gate out as an entryway," said Cressa. "Shield, I would like to dismount a moment. You will assist me."
"My honour."
Gathley jumped off his own horse and came over to hold Nightmist's head. But instead of sliding off by herself, as was her practice, Cressa reached toward the guard. Automatically, he held up his arms to grab her waist and assist her down. Once she was on the ground, Cressa kept her hand touching his shoulder.
"Gathley, who paid you to give information?"
"Treasurer Presions, man,"
he answered in a flat tone. "Do you know why they wanted this information?"
"They said 'twas to double check on your safety."
"You aren't stupid, Gathley. Who else is working with Matwick?"
"I spoke only with Presion's manservant."
"What was the plan?" The Queen's fingers dug into his uniform.
"Your Majesty was the killer's target. They wanted to capture the girl."
"Why would they move against me, and why now?"
"I do not know for a surety, but I think because Matwick's term is almost up. Another election for a new steward at midsummer."
"Did anyone tell you that, or did you figure it out yourself?"
"Stands to reason,"
Gathley shrugged. "And what is in it for the others?"
"Riches. Buckets of jewels. He paid me with a diamond, a real diamond. Had a big fucking time finding a merchant to change it into coin."
"Who else is working for them?" Cressa pressed. "My ladies?"
"I think though I'm not sure about the one from Maritima. What's her name? The one with the lyre. The others delay until she leaves the room to whisper together. Any more from the Queen's shield? Bristle interrupted, his voice rough-edged. No, said Gathley. The palace guard? Bristle asked. The palace guard follows orders, Gathley answered ambiguously.
What do you know about Oromondo?
The Queen asked.
Oromondo? Nothing firsthand. Heard a whisper about a letter yesterday.
Are any further actions planned for today? Cressa inquired.
No one has said naught to me. I'm thinking they might need to regroup.
Cressa looked up at Bristle on his horse, asking with her glance if he had any more questions. He shook his head and started to reach for his sword. She brushed him off. If Gathley went missing now, someone might notice.
Shield, give me a lift back into the saddle. Then you will ride back to the palace. You will remember only that you carried out Bristle's command and that Westgate was locked. You never saw me on this path, and we never spoke. Do you understand?
Yes.
He bent and hoisted her left calf to give her more momentum into the saddle. Then he remounted and rode off as if he didn't see them. Bristle let out a whoosh of air. Cressa wiped her cheeks and forehead with the hem of her cloak.
I ken your queen and all, but I didn't know you could do that, Bristle said.
I was not sure myself. But as the chroniclers say, you find the talent when you need it.
We should have you question the envoy, said Bristle.
Aye, if we can do so without anyone knowing. I need to keep this talent secret.
As they rode back to the palace, Bristle began muttering under his breath.
What? Cressa asked.
This will just madden the captain, he said. Fucking arsehole traitor! I would have gladly run him through on the spot. Oathbreaker! Pig fucker!
Cressa nodded, but she was less shocked by Gathley's perfidy.
Words will only hold those who want to be held. Her mind lingered on the import of what they had learned. The election. Matwick will be expected to step down graciously because the typical term of service is 1 10-year cycle. But if the Queen were dead and the Princella only an unprotected child, would he dare postpone the vote? A man who would kill his Queen would dare anything. He intends to rule through Cerulea. Whatever happens, he must never get his hands on her.